and let the record reflect all members are present with the exception of District Engineer Harris.
Okay, with that, we'll move to public comments. We don't have any public visiting us today. If someone does come, we'll certainly reopen it, but we'll close public comments and move to the minutes from the last meeting.
And I'll make a motion we accept the meetings as shown.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And with that, we'll go to presentations. Steph.
Okay. We have brought to you in the past the issue of the broken water pipe underneath Willow Lake. And the issue regarding that pipe has always been, what is the effect on our ability to provide fire hydrant water pressure in the event of a fire, because we've closed that pipe off? What has been the effects? What have been the impacts? And we've gone back and forth with fire on various scenarios on, does this constitute something we should worry about? Is this an emergency, not an emergency? And we've kind of gone back and forth if we've exchanged information on this. And the bottom line is that we received a letter from fire that states that we are in potential violation for not having potential significant water flow during peak periods. And a staff here can talk more about that if you're interested in those numbers. But the bottom line is they say that it needs to be immediately repaired. The implications are is that to do this, there's a normal process where you go through CEQA, fishing game, and get various approvals to get this done. That can take some time. It could take up to a year. And we will be a year from now, we would go through the actual high peak period of summer, which puts the town at risk of not having enough pressure to put out a fire. So based on the fact that fire flows could get so low and we have this condition that the fire department believes is an emergent condition, that we want to declare this an emergency, and by doing so, we're able to proceed a lot faster in getting the new pipe replaced underneath Willow Lake to ensure that if there was a fire where there's a risk of serious damage to property or possible risk to life, that we can be have this resolved and make sure that the water pressure is there when they need it. Now, for particulars, I have Justin and I also have Mike Iraqua to answer any particular questions on fire pressure flow.
I'm up to speed enough to realize that when the fire department says you got to get it fixed right away, I'm going to lean on the side of the fire department, but I think we need to move forward expeditiously as possible.
And the only, I know I had this question before when I first heard it, it's being replaced with an 8-inch pipe, and that's
under an emergency situation, it needs to be 8-inch. We couldn't go higher. CEQA won't allow us to go bigger than what's there.
Okay.
It's about actually replacing the pipe.
Which
provides, I think Justin would agree, enough fire flow to satisfy all the conditions.
It satisfies necessary. The fire flow requirement, and that was the threshold that the fire department came to. Is before it broke, there was hydrants that were marginal, but they were satisfying the fire flow requirement. And when that pipe broke, it brought them just below it. So they said, well, now we're in violation because it's below the fire flow requirement.
So the diagram, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but the diagram you have, it shows the old pipe and it's a dotted line. It looks like it goes along the contour of the bank and then down and under. Mm-hmm. And this one looks like it's much deeper.
Right. So this is the method for horizontal directional drilling for the replacement of the underwater.
That's what I mean by that.
Yeah. So it's a drill process, and very good precision in terms of directing the borehole and where it's going to go. And the reason they would want it so low is to get it far enough below the lake to prevent any issues of frack out.
Sure. And the actual dig itself, once the apparatus is in, do you have any idea how long it takes? Is that a day's worth of dig?
Probably within a week they would have it. They would have the drill bore pipeline installed, and then the rest would just be the surface pipeline improvements to connect it back into the system.
And I showed the two islands on the two streets you're coming into, so you're going to move the valves from the people's property over to the island on both sides?
I don't think we've gotten to that detail right there, but we are talking about replacing some of the valves exactly because some of them, as Aaron found out, are leaking by when they're closed. So we're going to use this opportunity as long as we have the street opened up to go ahead and put in new valves.
So the homeowner will still have an E on both sides, still have an easement down the side. They just lose that cover with the valves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe we were planning on replacing that, correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. And that's in the budget. And the budget hasn't changed. The budget we presented to you a month ago is still the same budget.
But and the two homeowners, it's not a big deal to them. And it's not usable space anyway, I presume, to them.
Right now they have lawn and shrubbery over the easement area.
Mm-hmm. So potentially they could get that back.
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't be giving up any easement area. We would still have. We still maintain the 10-foot easement and work within that 10-foot easement. But potentially those valves come out, which means they would no longer see any surface visible, you know, sign of the pipe. If we decide to take those valves out.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So we're just looking for the recommendation of the committee that we proceed with declaring this an emergency situation and proceed with the appropriate filing of documents and expediting construction.
I would make a motion, and I'll make the motion. You make the motion. Staff recommend. Follow staff's recommendation.
I'll second.
Any questions?
Aye.
Well, follows the thing. Aye.
The one thing that is profound here is that we're getting a letter from the fire department.
We have the letter.
Yeah, we have the letter. Okay, mm-hmm. And you can't dispute that this has to be done.
It's correct.
So, vote or no vote, we got to get the vote, obviously, but it has to be done.
Well, we can ignore it, be potential violation,
yes.
Be subject to criminal and civil penalties for it. But, you know, we take CEQA very, very seriously, and we take, fish and game very, very seriously. So, this is something that, it's kind of, we can't risk life and property.
That's
yeah, and to that point, if fish and game did come knocking or whatever, that's what we would say. We'd say, look, we have this letter.
Well,
risk life and property.
The other issue I see, as far as I'm concerned, is that the disturbance to the aquatic life,
mm-hmm.
fish and all that, will be much less doing it this way. Mm-hmm. So the intrusion or the concerns that they may have, I don't think it would be there because we're not going directly on them. On the shore or the bed.
Right.
And to the residents as well. This will be less disruptive for the residents, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask a question to clarify in case it comes up about what's the difference in us doing the emergency compared to non emergency when it comes to the CEQA?
So, under non emergency, the CEQA itself would probably take about 3 months. And then after that, do the normal fish and game and Army Corps of Engineers, which Gregory Harris can attest to, they may not even respond who knows what they're going to do. And that's what Mike was saying. And the whole process could take up to a year when it's all said and done before we can release the contractor to actually start boring underneath and getting the work done. And, then we've gone through another summer of having substandard fire protection, which is what the fire department is saying in their letter.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they're saying, don't let this happen again.
Okay, so our recommendation is to bring to the board for their consideration, and we'll go from there.
That concludes our report.
Okay. Well, with that, future discussion?
Can we go back to wastewater update before we...
Oh, sure.
Studies and some other things that are recommended in there. One of those is the oxygen transfer test. The
$15,000, and then there's some chemical costs that we probably go through Veolia. We have Veolia buy. It's about $90,000. So it's running around $24,000, $25,000 in that ballpark. And I'm getting that nailed down, but basically wanted to bring that to the next board meeting for approval. So that we can start that in January, that testing sometime in January. And that's important for us to proceed to receive the design. It's, you know, it's an important part of that design.
And the fees for this testing and chemicals, et cetera, they're in the entire budget number, right?
Yes, yeah, they're in the original budget. So I have a copy of the proposal, but I mean, it's just a proposal written up, and that's basically what it is. And it's in the original master plan budget number, so we can review it. Okay? So that's one update on that. The other update is I did want to confirm that, are we going to have the December 18th meeting?
Yes.
We are. So on the diffuser project, you guys have forgotten about that, to get that seat. The MND is done, and they need, they're going to be bringing that forward for approval for the mitigating of deck on the diffuser project and the notice of intent. So I plan to bring those documents to the board for approval by the board so that we can publish those in the newspaper, et cetera.
Yeah, while we're on that diffuser, just came to mind. I spoke with you, I don't know, 3-4 years ago about the idea of trying to put in a hydraulic pump for generating electricity, and there's companies to do that. And at the time, it would cost us more to push the flow of water. My thought is, if we've got to take that diffuser pipe out, we've now got gravity in our favor going down. Is there some way that we could take a look at putting in one of those electric generating water flow items in that project?
Yeah. Still the same answer.
Still the same.
You don't get more energy out than you put in, so it doesn't go. Sorry. I'm not excited about that, but it doesn't go.
Well,
so the fact that I turn around with downhill. The problem is it only goes downhill for a little bit sometimes. Sometimes it's under pressure from the pump. And then sometimes I get a little bit of gravity effect as I go to the top of the burn. But that's only a couple feet ahead. It doesn't happen all the time. It would be.
I was trying to help mitigate our $95,000 a month electric.
Okay. Solar will do a good job on that. But just turbine will not.
So water flow isn't going to work regardless of how efficient those pumps are.
I only put 25 horsepower in. You don't get more than 25 horsepower out. That's the way it is.
So just for perspective, the Los Vaqueros Reservoir, right?
Yeah.
So it's way up there on the hill. Huge gravity pipeline coming down. Contra Costa Water did a study to put the generator, one megawatt generator at the bottom. The payback for the capital cost to put it in, was 35 years.
Oh,
it would take 35 years of energy savings to pay back what the capital cost was to put it in. To do that, and that's a beautiful situation. You got hundreds of feet of water flow coming down. But here it's a pump situation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just to give you a perspective that these things really only work when you have huge amounts of height of water above to generate.
Yeah. This is a company, kind of new technology, they're out of Berkeley, and they've got some pilot programs going. Okay, I ventured out on that one, and I'll sit back down.
So we have, bring it up 5 years from now, too.
We have additional update from Dina on asset management plan.
Yeah, so we got together, myself, Mike, Aaron, Bernie, and Justin, and we started working, or the big groundwork for working on an asset management plan for water. So Justin's here tonight just to give you kind of a high-level overview of what we're going to be, what we've started, and where we're going to go.
All right. So I'm just going to pass around these handouts here. Right? And Bernie, you can pass these down. Just some questions. What we're going to talk about tonight is a very high-level overview for asset management. Let's tell everybody about that. So the packet that's in front of you is just something that I was going to reference while we're talking, but it's really just the inventory of our water system, and that's the focus of an asset management plan is inventory and replacements. So it's really a thought process, a strategic thought process on replacements and aging infrastructure. And that's something that we felt has been lacking in the system and in the plan for main lines primarily. But we're also thinking about it with regards to wells and pumps, built-in components of the system. So the more we talked about it, the more we realized what we're really thinking about is an asset management plan, and it's a coordinating effort, it's a group effort, and there's a lot of information from a lot of sources. A lot of parts of it kind of relate to a water master plan and what a water master plan is looking at, but it's not really independent look at the system like a master plan might be. Somebody studying your supply and your demand and your growth and how you're meeting growth with new capacity. It's not as much about new capacity as it is about conditions of infrastructure. So we're starting to talk about this, and so we thought, well, let's just do an overview to everybody on what we're thinking about. So the asset man, what is it? It's a program, and it's taking information from our known assets and putting a plan together for replacement of aging, deteriorating infrastructure. So it's really a methodology that involves ranking matrix that's taking criteria in areas to identify the areas of greatest need. And right now we're thinking, wrapping our arms around, mainly the main lines, but the whole component of the water system is several different asset categories. And we have wells, pumps, we have the piping, and the above ground stations, the filters, reservoirs, motor control centers.
Well, the plan will help us itemize, prioritize, or have a group of projects, which help.
That's the idea. Like, I think right now, today, we could get pretty close to saying this is where we're at on CIPs, and these are the needs of the system right now. And an asset management plan would be a strategic approach to back in the prioritization. And it would be a living document. So once the process is in place, we would be able to update that process. Say we go and do a mainline project as a result of it, we would get so much information out of that mainline project that could feed back into this asset management process to update our thinking on the condition of mainlines and the need for replacements.
Right, but it also will help us on a rate study.
Yeah, I mean, I think the competing issues there is that the rate study is wanting to be done by May, and I think the asset management plan is usually a process that would take longer than a few months. I mean, I think bridging the gap between now and the rate study would be saying we could get pretty close in terms of what should be being budgeted over the next 5 years without doing a full-blown asset management plan, just by looking at some pretty broad indicators about the age and material types. I mean, that's one of the figures in here is looking at pipe material types and looking at the fact that some of it's 50 years old and it's AC pipe, which has a lifespan of 75 years under good conditions. And we're already starting to see signs of failure, so we could already wrap our arms around that. We've got 10 miles of pipe we should be looking at replacing over the next 5 to 10 years. So in terms of kind of cutting the chase for the rate study, I think that might be a dual track thing where we can come up with, preliminary, this is what we should be looking at in 5 to 10 years. But we should also be establishing a process amongst ourselves of how we're
going to do it. Right, have a formal process to do it, but because of the rate study, we look forward, fast forward it out to get that information so we're sure we've got it in there, even though we're going to be doing this 5 or 6, 7 years down the road.
Yep, and every time you do a project, you're getting more information that you can feed back into your asset management plan. So that's the concept, mainly, that I'm talking about here, is we want to get good information for the rate study, and I think we could broadly get pretty good information for the rate study right now. But we also don't want to shortcut the process, and we want to have a good, a good plan together for the water system, over the next 10 or more years of the infrastructure. So the first step in the thorough part of the asset management plan is the inventory. And what I have in this packet is the just kind of a snapshot of inventory. This is just from reports that we put together. This isn't tables that Veolia has from the database. Veolia maintains a GIS database, and they have a lot more information than we pumps and pipelines. And that's all I have here. But the things that are missing from this are the valves and instrumentation, chlorination system, chlorine pumps, all of the switch gear and motor controls. And within the distribution system, I've got a good handle on length, you know, fairly good handle on material types. There's a big list of unknowns, but we know those are all C900. But what's not here, and what I'm pretty sure Veolia is going to have in the GIS, is all of the service line materials, the valves, the hydrants, a lot more of the inventory. So that's like the first step, is get all the inventory together and organize it in terms of, you know, age, material, any indicators, any of these you know, basic pieces of information really about the inventory. And then the next step is conducting the condition assessment. And condition assessment is partially from a geo database analysis, looking at age and material type, for example, or in a pipeline, we'd be looking at not just age and material type, but historic failures, if there's been any corrosion testing, any specific site-specific information, failures and replacements, and also the soil type, looking at soil maps and comparing soil maps to where we have AC pipe, which is can be degraded sooner if you have corrosive soils around the AC pipe. So that is like an initial step in terms of condition assessment. And condition assessment is a little bit different for each system, though. That's main lines. When we're looking at wells and pumps, we do testing every 2 years on the wells and pumps, and that looks at the trends of how they perform. And we establish the replacement maintenance strategies for wells and pumps based on that biannual testing. And so that would feed into the condition assessment for this. And then also, Veolia has a lot of records in terms of how they maintain and operate the filters, the plants, the instrumentation. And so they would have a lot of judgment call to be made in terms of the condition of those facilities. You know, whereas we've been handling a lot of the wells and pumps, and we could provide a lot of input on that. Veolia can provide a lot of input on the filters and tanks and the MCCs, the things that they're day-to-day, you know, doing a lot of maintenance and replacement on. And then the piping is really that, you know, that first part of what I was saying, which is more of a geo database analysis. Another component of this isn't just condition assessment, it's what's the consequence of failure. It's kind of like, so what if a pump fails? Don't we have a lot of capacity? You know, so that's a part of this analysis, is looking again at demand and supply and our reliability and how we think about reliability amongst having, you know, enough well supply to feed the treatment plants, and what happens if a particular well fails, and what's the impact on supply and the operation. We've been, you know, honing in on some water quality issues on a couple of particular wells that we know that if another well fails and we're relying more on those wells with potential water quality that are producing water quality issues, it impacts us more than if a different well fails. So there's a different level of impact depending on what the asset is. So there's a consequence of failure associated with it. And same with piping. You know, we just saw the underwater crossing fail. If it was a different crossing in another part of town, it would have had a totally different impact on the system. So there's a different consequence of failure as a result of that underwater crossing. So taking in, you know, all of these factors into essentially ranking and prioritizing based upon likelihood of failure and consequences of failure. Those are the two buzzwords in asset management plans. What's the likelihood of it failing? And if it fails, what's the consequence of it failing? And then ranking that to prioritize your replacements, essentially. And then updating that as you go. You know, as you obtain more information, go underground and dig pipes and see the actual condition. But establishing that process, that's what this whole first step is really about, is establishing the framework for that process.
Yeah, this is going to take a big collaboration of all of us working together, but I think it's definitely going to be something that's needed and going to take us far into the future so that we can spearhead things before they happen, hopefully. So,
what's the time frame, you think?
I think this is probably going to take us a pretty good year.
I probably should give us a year to do something like this.
Yeah, to really make it a very good asset management plan. We're gonna combine that with the GIS services that Veolia has, and then create some maps for Aaron, so when he has issues, he can mark them, and we can just start sharing information, which we never have done before, so.
And I'd say we do share the information, but it's not as systematic.
Yeah.
I think the idea here is to create more of a process, more of a standard operating procedures for how when one set of information is collected from one group, how it's shared, and establishing those roles amongst the group, you know.
Yeah.
And the
sharing of information will be better than it was before. So,
right.
You know, if there
correct.
Was a water leak, somebody would go fix the water leak but forget to tell this person, that person. So I think we're working together to be a better team, so that we're all informed and we can make better decisions going forward.
This is a beautiful document.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it is too.
This will raise hundreds of questions, but we would have never thought to ask them if we didn't see something like this. So
yeah.
That's good. It's good to consolidate and continue to build on it.
Yeah.
For the completeness and accuracy.
Great. Yeah, I'm glad you think so, because this is a small percentage of the actual assets out there, and we would like the table of assets to be exhaustive of everything, you know, and so it's this table's not there. I know once we pull our information together, it'll, from where we're at today, already be way bigger than this set of information. The old has a lot.
Well, it's just becoming a working living document.
Yes.
Right, that's the idea. And
because people in the future will be able to look at that, they don't have to reinvent the wheel.
That's right.
Right. And one way that, you know, from a high level view, the way I've been thinking about it is, you know, what we've been doing the last 10, 20 years is addressing the growth in the system, and that's where the master plans were really coming into play. We've now gotten to a point where we see the growth, and there isn't any growth plan beyond that. And the improvements that have been thought of are already in place on the CIP, going to get done, and will address that growth. And so now we're starting to see these other signs of, you know, things fail. And each time we ask ourselves, how important is that piece of equipment? And, you know, we don't want to replace it unless we have to. We want to know how critical it is. And, you know, so it's becoming more about this R&R, this removal replacement program. And just having a good thought process up front, so we don't have to be figuring it out each time for the first time.
It's very exciting. We haven't done this before. So future planning is.
I have two questions. Mm-hmm. One is, I see that a lot of your crossings are ductile iron, and I believe the one that failed is ductile iron also. Now that's the thing, is that the as-built that Aaron found showed called out cast iron.
Right.
Okay. So we found welded steel.
Right.
And that's going to be one of the things that we're going to be talking about. I mean, getting back to the board in the future, is we'd like to recommend that we put body protection on all those crossings, assuming that they are also
prevent them
from corroding to getting to where this one is.
And the treated plant, all of our testing has shown the soil here is crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy corrosive.
Yeah, we've seen that too.
And I was going to say, in terms of your CIP, I would recommend, as a minimum, you get some geotechnical testing to verify if not, or play it safe and say, go put cathodic protection if it's not on already.
We're going to focus
on all the crossings.
Yeah.
I already have a quote from JDH Corrosion to do that way.
Alright.
And that's part of the system that we could wrap our arms around pretty quickly already, that we'll be having in place for CIP for grade 7.
Right.
We already know we're going to need to do.
Okay, and then you mentioned that the asbestos cement pipe had a shorter life in the high corrosive soil.
Yeah.
So you might want to do some soil testing to verify how corrosive the soil is.
Yeah.
I think it's very corrosive.
Yeah.
And that you may be shortening the life of the asbestos cement.
I think so too. And we're at the 50-year mark for a lot of them, and the book value for them is 75. So I would say we're getting into that zone where we really kind of need to know how the corrosive soil has impacted it. And you know, I mean, I kind of think of this as being kind of two steps. Where like the first step is, what information do we have, and what condition can we make a judgment on from there,
mm-hmm.
and then have focused areas. And then the second step is in actually going in and digging things up and testing and getting better information to kind of refine that first cut.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had done a 11 p.m. ride along with Virgil one night out in Prestwick, almost up into Cherry Hills. And it was interesting as I sat there listening to JW Backo, the folks that were there. Is it common? Is this something? Well, it's the material that they use for the bolts, he said.
Mm.
So that's something I don't see that could be here as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, I said, how big is it? And there's a few here. We've been replacing them, and they just give way due to the soil, I guess, the erosion with the soil.
Yeah.
Good choice in the year they chose it. It apparently cost them what they thought to be strong material. But
right. And a lot of times they think of, you know, asbestos cement or PVC to be, you know, non-metallic. It is non-metallic, but anytime you're going to have a restrained fitting or anytime you have a bolt, now you're relying on metal.
Right.
Anytime you put in a valve, you're relying on metal. So. Crust soil is an issue, and Mike, do you, in the cathodic protection systems that you've seen, because I know you're really familiar with them, do they apply it at each individual valve as well, like fitting and bend?
Yeah, if the soil is corrosive, as Gregory indicated, then you may perhaps you take some cables and you do what's called you catweld the cables to the valves. And you go like you bond between the valve and the fitting and another valve, whatever's in that cluster right there. Then from that, you would take over to what's called a sacrificial anode, just like your anode into a hot water heater that sticks in the water. It's magnesium, just like that. And you bury that in the ground, you have a test station, and all those right there are protected by one, say, 16 pound or 32 pound anode that's in the ground.
Yeah.
So then you have to continue with a test program every 2 years, go back and test that to make sure it's still working properly.
Right. So that would be more on new installation rather than retrofit. That would
also when you replace the valve.
When you replace the valve
or do
like a mainline project or
right.
something, that would be built into that.
Right. That's when these guys go out to do what you're saying, they have all this equipment with them. Add everything together, drop it in anode along before the backfill occurs,
yeah.
And now you got protection on that system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good.
That was just a discussion, really.
Yeah.
I'll let you know what we're thinking about,
yeah.
And what we'll probably be bringing in more detail in future meetings.
Yeah, well, I think it's timely, and we don't have an asset management plan. We need one, so we got to get started sometime. So we'll start.
Yeah, and then I think the idea is we're not holding that with regard to the time frame for the rate study.